Good afternoon. My name is Susan Muirhead, and today I'll be reading part one of the News Gazette, dated for this date, Tuesday, February 11th, 2025. As always, we begin with today's top stories. The first headline reads, A Life Remembered, Darnell DJ Wicks, W-Y-C-K-S. He lit up the room anywhere he was. 7-year-old was huge fan of Spider-Man. This article is written by Luke Taylor and is based out of Urbana. The 7-year-old who died in a shooting Saturday night in Urbana left a mark on his family and community with his loving nature and sense of humor. Darnell, or DJ, Wicks, his aunt, Quanisha Akerr, A-K-E-R, said he got that sense of humor from parents Malaysia Wicks and Darnell Hayes, who, along with the rest of their family, left him to the moon and back. He lit up the room anywhere he was, Akerr said. He was a ray of sunshine wherever he went. He will be truly missed by us all. DJ was one of two people killed in the shooting Saturday night. Officers who responded also located Melvin Braxton, 43, who had also been shot and had both taken to a local hospital. Both succumbed to their injuries and were pronounced dead that evening. The night before, another shooting in Urbana, which police said was unrelated, took the life of 18-year-old Sherman D. McCraney. A Sunday night memorial for DJ drew dozens of family, friends, and community members who released red balloons, one of his favorite colors. DJ was a huge Spider-Man fan, so his other favorite color was blue. His mom even set up a Spider-Man-themed photo shoot for him to have pictures as his favorite hero. Anytime him and his mom came and went, they always said to each other, I love you once, I love you twice, I love you more than red beans and rice, Akerr said. Akerr said that DJ spent a lot of time with her children, especially since her youngest is about to turn 7, as well as the rest of their large extended family. Her dad, DJ's grandfather, was his baseball coach, and Wicks, DJ's mom, was his basketball coach. Wicks has also been very involved with DJ's school, which Akerr said he loved, and his teachers adored him. Akerr said Wicks was at Bottenfield Elementary nearly every day to help out in one way or another, most recently organizing National African American Parent Involvement Day, which was Monday. Monday night's Champaign School Board meeting began with Superintendent Sheila Boozer calling for a moment of silence in honor of DJ and David Manny, that's M-A-N-N-I, a Stratton Academy of the Arts student who she said died over the holidays. This weekend's shootings led Urbana Mayor Diane Marlin and mayoral candidates Deshaun Williams and Annie Adams to call for initiatives to deal with gun violence in the city. Alderman Chandra Bishop, who represents the ward where the Saturday shooting happened, expanded those calls to community-based violence prevention programs, mental health resources, and safe and supportive environments for young people. My heart is with the families and loved ones grieving this devastating loss. No family should have to endure such pain, and no child should have their future stolen by violence, Bishop said. This tragedy is a call to action. We cannot accept violence as a norm in our city. And there's some great photos that are also provided. Well, one is provided, and it's of a little boy in a baseball uniform. The caption reads, The 7-year-old loved playing sports, especially on a baseball team, coached by his grandfather, and a basketball team coached by his mom. There's another photograph of DJ and his father smiling and like a selfie for the camera. Darnell DJ Wicks was all smiles and dad Darnell Hayes, who was a big part of his life. And there's another photograph with his mother in front of a red backdrop. Looks like they're wearing some pajamas. And they're smiling for the camera. The caption reads, Malaysia Wicks and her son, Darnell DJ Wicks. The next headline reads, It's actually just a large photo of a group of people standing in front of a big block eye. It says, "Welcome to town." And the caption reads, "Six educators and advocates from Lithuania, from left. Archer Adam Markovic, Lena Garbanicute, Christina Zaltoskiani, Vilmantis Bakikanas, Jatina Krupien, and Agne Multajun arrived at Willard Airport in Savoy on Friday to kick off a week-long stay in Champaign-Urbana that is part of Rotary Open World Program. Included in the group's many stops is tonight's Illini men's basketball game against UCLA, where the visitors will cheer on the home team's star point guard, Lithuanian native Kasparas Džiugusionis. So we welcome them to Urbana and Champaign. Next up, Krannert Center for the Performing Arts. Rock Show, a chance for mom to honor son's memory. This article is written by Joey Wright and is based out of Urbana. Diane Gottheil, G-O-T-T-H-E-I-L, thought of her late son, Josh, when she learned 10,000 Maniacs had booked a show at Krannert Center. Josh, who was passionate about promoting rock bands in local venues, had booked the band for a show at former campus town hotspot Mabel's shortly after graduating from Urbana High School in 1987. He was a little bit amazing as a promoter of rock music, Gottheil said, adding that she dropped Josh off at many of the shows and he organized to ensure the venue would let the 18-year-old inside. When I saw they were coming again, I talked to my daughter and we decided that we should make a donation to Krannert for this event, she said Monday. Diane donated 30 balcony tickets for tonight's show to Urbana Middle School, where an award bearing Josh Gottheil's name is given out every year to be used by students and their families. Gottheil and a friend will be there as well, watching from the venue's lower level. I was thinking, wow, wouldn't it be great if some of the Urbana music students could be there, Gottheil said. I didn't think they were interested in 80s music, but you never know. Jane's Addiction, Descendants, They Might Be Giants, and the Pixies were among the bands that Josh helped bring to Champaign-Urbana before his battle with lymphoma ended on April 4th, 1989. His mother's donation was an easy way to check several boxes that are important to her, while introducing students to a band that charted in the Billboard Top 200 four times, from 1987 to 1997. It just seemed that it would be a nice moment to combine some of the things I care about, Gottheil said, which is Krannert and Urbana music students and the memory of my son. And there's a photo provided, and it looks like a playbill from, it says 10,000 Maniacs, the Connells, Thursday, October 29th, Mabel's. Ticket $7 in advance. So again, I think that was from either 1987. Yes, they played in 1987, many years ago. All right, the next story reads, Soybean Innovation Lab, UI-based program looking for a miracle, shut down scheduled for April 15th. I'll say that again, shut down. Scheduled for April 15th due to loss of USAID funding. This article is written by Jana Wiersema and is based out of Urbana. Most people in the United States likely take the soybean for granted, but there are those who call it a miracle crop, said Peter Goldsmith, director and principal investigator at the Soybean Innovation Lab based at the University of Illinois. That includes the federal government, which provided funding in 2013 that led to the lab's creation. According to Goldsmith, the government was interested in the possibility of opening new markets in Africa, including soybeans, since the crop had had success in other regions. It certainly does a lot for us in Illinois, Goldsmith said. It does a lot for folks in Asia, in South America, and they thought it could do a lot for the industries and the economies in Africa. They wanted to know if there was a market for soybean. The verdict, success, as indicated by the lab's funding being renewed in 2016, and again in 2022, with the latest round of money set to last through 2027. Until recently, that is. Goldsmith recently announced, via LinkedIn posts on both his and the lab's profiles, that it is set to close April 15th, as all U.S. aid funding has ceased. The Soybean Innovation Lab is part of the U.S. Agency for International Development's Feed the Future program, which is aimed at addressing hunger and poverty around the world. It is operated in partnership with the U of I and located on campus in Urbana. Today, I had to let go of a staff of 30, Goldsmith wrote. These individuals are not only unique experts in the field of tropical soybean, but also close colleagues and friends who are now unexpectedly out of work. The land grant system now loses 19 crown jewel innovation labs across 17 states that delivered high and measurable impact on very little investment. Goldsmith told the News Gazette on Monday that he hopes to demonstrate this tremendous return on investment to the federal government and convince them that the program is worthy of continued funding. President Donald Trump and his supporters have talked of shutting down USAID, reducing its programs, and placing what's left under the State Department, according to the Associated Press. On Friday, U.S. District Judge Carl Nichols temporarily blocked an order that would have placed thousands of U.S. aid workers on administrative leave and given those in other countries 30 days to move back to the United States at government expense, the AP reported. However, Nichols declined to block a freeze that has affected almost all of the agency's funding. Goldsmith said he is working with partners from the U of I, Washington, D.C., and other innovation labs to get an expedited review of their funds and programming in the hopes that they may be reinstated. In discussing the benefits of his lab's work, Goldsmith said it has opened markets in Africa for U.S. soybean farmers and helped remove the risk to them as they enter this frontier market, quote unquote. Previously, Africa's market was primarily based on palm oil. Historically, even as recent as the early part of the century, there were 3 units of palm oil for every 1 unit of soy, he said. Soy was inconsequential in Africa. We've now reversed that. It's now under 2 units and improving at about 2.2% a year. He added that soy is also a good crop for producing economic growth and poverty reduction in the communities they've introduced it to, making it the right thing to do as well as the smart thing. That's the genius of the investment, Goldsmith said. There are no losers here. Conversely, he argued, closing the lab is a loss to both sides. U.S. soybean farmers lose one of their best tools to expand their markets and U.S. standards globally, he wrote in his LinkedIn post. Local economies in emerging markets lose soybean as an incomparable engine growing wealth, prosperity, and economic development. He added that there would also be political consequences as food insecurity can lead to instability. Additionally, America's influence in the region would be diminished and other actors such as China may fill that void, Goldsmith said. As the soybean lab awaits news of its future, Goldsmith has told employees to stop work and focus on themselves and their families. These individuals are still employed as the April 15th closing date looms, and Goldsmith said the U of I's College of Agricultural, Consumer and Environmental Sciences has generously provided funding to maintain their salaries in the interim, an expense that would or could be reimbursed if federal funding continues. The university's Human Resources Department has also been helping lab employees look for new opportunities. If the federal government decides to renew their funding, the firings could be undone, Goldsmith said. However, depending on the timing of that decision, staff may have already moved on to other jobs. Last week's staff meeting was very tearful, he said. We're a close family. We've worked together for a long time. We've worked well together. And there's a photograph that accompanies this article, too. One is of Goldsmith, like a smiling photograph of him. And then there's also a photo of a poster And the caption reads, a bulletin board in the halls of the Soybean Innovation Lab on the University of Illinois campus in Urbana describes its efforts to create a sustainable soybean industry across sub-Saharan Africa. And those photos are either provided or taken by Jana Wiersema of the News Gazette. At newsgazette.com, what say you? Let us know by submitting a letter to the editor online. The next headline reads, top of the morning, something to get you going today, courtesy of Vice President Jim Rosso. Matt Robert had a rock-solid excuse the one time he couldn't join his father, or his, excuse me, his fellow Philo Knights of Columbus members at the annual Polar Plunge in Mahomet. In 2016, he got married the same day. I was with them in spirit, said the 51-year-old Urbana, or from Urbana, adding that he sent the group a video of him jumping in a different and much warmer body of water in Cancun, Mexico. Robert and seven other brave and helpful KOCers, that's Philo Knights of Columbus, will be back at it Saturday at Lake of the Woods. Around noon, they'll jump into icy waters to benefit Special Olympics Illinois. The group's involvement began in 2007 and hasn't wavered a bit. It might sting jumping in, but preparing isn't bad at all. It involves, well, eating a lot. We all try to put on a few extra pounds of insulation, Robert said. Over the years, the Philo crew has raised more than $70,000. To donate to their cause, you can visit newsgazette.com. Afterward, Robert and company will gather at a member's house in Mahomet to hang out, laugh, and catch up. We're very proud, and we love doing this, he said. It's roughly 30 seconds to take, or to a minute, it's roughly 30 seconds to 1 minute, for them to have 2 weeks of a great time and sportsmanship at Special Olympics, Illinois Summer Games, and Bloomington Normal. It's definitely worth it. And there's a picture of a group of guys, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 9, looks like 9, outside in kind of sweatpants. Looks like they are about to take the plunge. This is an older photograph, sunny day. The caption reads, members of Philo Knights of Columbus at the 2024 Polar Plunge in Mahomet. That photo's provided. Good luck, guys. I get cold just thinking about it. Next up, history. Area history. In 1925, so great locally was the interest in the imprisonment of Floyd Collins in Sand Cave near Cave City, Kentucky, that four residents of Mansfield went to the scene of the accident. Their return was eagerly awaited by Mansfield citizens, as they undoubtedly would have a thrilling story to relate. In 1975, the Democratic Party dominated the Urbana primary ballot as voters headed to the polls to choose 16 city council candidates for the April 1st election. Of the 19 candidates, 6 were Republican, 11 were Democrats, and 1 was an independent. Only 2 of the council's 8 incumbents were seeking re-election. In 2010, Shahid Khan, the 55-year-old president of Urbana-based auto parts manufacturer Flexengate Corporation, had a tentative agreement to buy a 60% stake in the St. Louis Rams. And in international history, today's highlight, on February 11, 1990, South African anti-apartheid activist Nelson Mandela was freed after 27 years in prison. Mandela would be elected president of South Africa 4 years later. Also on this date, in 1847, American inventor Thomas Alva Edison was born in Milan, Ohio. In 1945, U.S. President Franklin D. Roosevelt, British Prime Minister Winston Churchill, and Soviet leader Joseph Stalin signed the Yalta Agreement, in which Stalin agreed to declare war against Imperial Japan following Nazi Germany's capitulation. In 1975, Margaret Thatcher was elected leader of Britain's opposition Conservative Party. Corrections. The News Gazette strives to present fair and accurate reporting and to correct any errors as promptly as possible. Corrections and clarifications for all sections run on this page. To report an error, please call 217-351-5252, that's 217-351-5252, then press 6 to reach the newsroom. And the next headline reads, we'll take a quick look at our weather forecast for the next few days. The country will have some severe winter weather in the next few days. We'll see how it impacts our area. Today, 36 degrees, mostly cloudy, northeast winds 10 to 15 miles per hour, overnight mostly cloudy, northeast winds 10 to 15 miles per hour. Wednesday, the high will be 31, the low will be 26. A chance of snow in the morning, then snow and freezing rain in the afternoon. Overnight, cloudy, snow and freezing rain in the evening. Thursday, colder. The high will be 21, the low is 18, mostly cloudy in the morning, then becoming mostly sunny. Friday, the high will be 31, the low will be 2, mostly sunny in the morning, then becoming mostly cloudy. Wind chill values as low as 5 below in the morning. And by Saturday, it will warm up a little bit. The high will be 38, the low is 27. Rain and snow, 90% likely. Little or no snow accumulation. So colder temperatures, perhaps some ice toward the end of the week. Please stay warm and be careful. Also, as a quick note, the stories that you read contain original reporting by News Gazette staff. If you're not a subscriber, please consider becoming one, because local journalism is only possible with your support. A subscription to the News Gazette plays a vital role in making this reporting possible. Thank you for your support and helping us continue to connect our community. The next headline reads, we now go to the B section of the paper, Town Hall, which every Tuesday is a collection of guest columns and editorials collected by Jeff D'Alessio. The next headline reads then, from Paul Barrett's column, Lagniappe, a Hall of Famer in my book. I met Rafael Palmeiro for the first time around 1992 after he was traded to the Texas Rangers from the Baltimore Orioles. His wife, Lisa, and I drove to Colleyville, Texas, outside Dallas, to visit the Palmeiro family at the new home they were building. Lisa and Rafael knew each other from their college days at Mississippi State, where his future wife, Lynn, and Lisa were roommates. She had visited the young couple during his Cubs rookie year, as they were so excited to be in the big leagues and in Chicago. On one occasion, he passed a ball around in the clubhouse and asked his teammates to sign it. He then gave it to Lisa. The house was about 80% complete, and we got the grand tour. I'm not sure exactly how large it was, at least 15,000 square feet. The home was on a cul-de-sac, and I believe Troy Aikman, then the Dallas Cowboys quarterback, was their neighbor. Pretty heady stuff for a couple of newlyweds from Mississippi. Their two young boys, Patrick and Preston, were running around discovering all the great places to play in that magnificent home. While Lynn and Lisa walked the house and caught up, Rafael was kind and generous with his time in giving me a tour. We talked baseball, of course, and he was sincerely interested in my career and playing days. At one point, he said, "You'll have to come back when the batting cage is finished in the basement. Take a few swings." I was already a fan before I got to meet him and knew about his career at Mississippi State, where he set several SEC batting records, some of which still stand. He was half of the Thunder and Lightning duo, along with Will Clark, that terrorized the SEC and broke numerous records on their way to the College World Series, along with teammate and future pro Bobby Thigpen. His professional resume with the Cubs, Orioles, and Rangers was a stellar one. So he's with the Cubs, Orioles, and Rangers. As one writer for the Wall Street Journal reported, he was a surefire first ballot Hall of Famer, but for the strain of a steroid scandal at the very end of his career. Just before his retirement, Rafael joined Hank Aaron, Willie Mays, Alex Rodriguez and Eddie Murray as the only player in Major League history to rack up 3,000 hits and 500 home runs. In 2004, he hit his 563rd 563 home run to pass Reggie Jackson on the all-time list. I don't know much about the steroid incident. Rafael claims he was given a vial of hand-marked B12 from a teammate and injected himself. He then tested positive for steroids. He had never tested positive before and tested negative 3 weeks later. But the damage was done, and he left baseball soon after the 10-game suspension. I and many sports writers believed him, several of them writing passionately about his harsh punishment after a clean, stellar career. The last time I saw Rafael was around 2005 when he was with the Orioles, and they were visiting Chicago to play the White Sox. Several colleagues and I went to the ballpark to see the game. At the time, our headquarters were at the Sun-Times, a paper we had owned for a few years. At one point, there was a rain delay, and we huddled under the overhang. I told my friends I was going to go down to the Orioles dugout and speak to Rafael. They laughed and said, "No way, you know Rafael Palmeiro." So I went down, through the rain, to the corner of the dugout, where a female police officer was standing guard. I asked her if she could see Rafael in the dugout, but she ignored me. I told her I was a friend, and again, no answer. At that point, another officer stepped out and said, "Who are you looking for?" I gave him a business card and asked him to give it to Rafael. He did. Within a minute, he came out, gave me a hug, and asked what in the world I was doing there. As I explained, I asked him to turn and wave to my friends high up under the roof. He put his arm around me and, standing there in the rain, waved to my disbelieving colleagues. I didn't buy another beer when play resumed. Yep, a surefire first ballot Hall of Famer, at least in my eyes. Paul Barrett is a COO, or is the COO, Chief Operating Officer of Central Illinois Multimedia Group and publisher of the News Gazette. He can be reached by email at pmbpub@aol.com. And there's a photo of Palmeiro running the bases on a sunny day at a baseball game. The caption reads, "Rafael Palmeiro, then with the Texas Rangers, circles the bases after hitting his 500th career home run on May 11th, 2003. That photo is provided by Bill Jansha from the Fort Worth Star-Telegram. The next headline reads, actually, there are three letters to the paper published today. I'll read as many as I can in this section as time permits, and then I'll follow up in part two of the News Gazette with the rest of them. So in case you feel like I'm being partial, I will read them all in time. Here's the first one. Not unpolite, but not happy either. In regard to Peggy Pritchard's recent Midlife Musings column, I don't consider myself, quote-unquote, unpolite. But I am, in fact, deeply incensed about the inauguration of Donald Trump. Like Pritchard, I have the good fortune of friends and family on both sides. I bear none of them any ill will. But I'm not nearly as optimistic as she is that we'll all ultimately be okay. Even if some are, what about impacts and costs to the rest of us? Remember when Republicans convinced Richard Nixon to resign rather than defend himself against impeachment? In the wake of January 6th, many Republicans condemned Trump and the rioters. We all saw that insurrection attempt. It's remarkable how quickly those brave Republicans folded to the Trump card. It shouldn't have been a tough choice in November. A prosecutor ran against a convicted felon. It makes no sense to me that anyone can claim to cherish the values of law and order, politeness, respect, and decency, but then accept blatant disrespect for those values with a vote for Trump. How do Christian ideals of compassion, mercy, and love work for families separated in immigration and customs enforcement detention camps? How can nice be applied in the context of a vindictive president who intends to lock up his opponents? Does forgiveness extend to unrepentant January 6 rioters? That's from Tim Prescott in Champaign. I'm Susan Muirhead, and this has been part one of the News Gazette, dated for this date, February 11th, 2025. I'll be back to read part two with you shortly. Have a wonderful day.